thing
that does
on.
It for this edition of Off the
there
Hour.
There's a thing
thank,
going on.
Thank you, Stu Lee.
Our consciousness is a
thank you
thing.
Very much
thing going on.
For listening. Thank you, Stu Lee Avalanche, for hosting and engineering this program. And a big thank you to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. For more information or a copy of anything you've heard tonight, or if you would like to participate in news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news at ckut.ca. Stay tuned, a special edition of Hearsays on deck and coming up next. For the rest of the crew, this is Kevin saying we'll see you in 7. Have a good night. Avalanche out.
Excuse me.
Come on, come on.
This is for the warm days that drift away while the sun sets and the ghettos play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for you and your crew, the ones that's true. Will always love you, no matter what you do.
Rise is the light, the light, the light, the light, the light. Rise the light, the light, the light.
Breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices.
Two queens, raise their kids, implement the knowledge, show them how to learn. This is for those who stand in line to feed their babies while we're running out of time. This is for the injustice beyond bars. Our lovers, our leaders, our people.
The light, the light, the light, the light, the light. It's
Good evening. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 Spitfire Radio, Women of Color Radio, every last Wednesday of the month. This evening, we have a lot of great stuff for you out there. We're going to start off with an interview by Alicia, followed by a piece by Stephanie on a fact-finding mission in the Philippines. We also have a book review by our very own Malek. We have a piece on transnational surrogates by Lindsay, and a little comment on the surge on anti-black racism post-Obama. So stay tuned and listen up.
Trying to find the way on this is for everybody and anybody's soul.
Hello, all of you out there in Radio Land. We're bringing you a book review by Mr. Solomon Schimmel. It's called The Tenacity of Unreasonable Beliefs, Fundamentalism, and the Fear of Truth. Quoting Dr. Alan Dershowitz, some of you out there might know him. It's beyond the scope of this review to discuss the intellectual abilities of said reviewer, but hey. So he says, quote, "This is a long overdue book about a pressing subject by a brilliant writer qualified not only by his professional expertise but also by his own life experiences. The question of why otherwise thoughtful people accept irrational religious fundamentalism is a difficult one to address in our age of oversensitivity about challenging deeply held religious beliefs." Well, my friends, I'm here to tell you the truth could be anything but. So I wrote this little letter to Dr. Schimmel. That's how I want to do this review here, and I hope you'll entertain me. Here's some of my thoughts. "Dearest Dr. Schimmel, greetings from a fellow fundamentalist. As you so eloquently state in the book, we should not be politically correct or oversensitive to feelings. When discussing the matter of religion, wherein the stakes for democracy, quote-unquote, are so high. So I'll have to ask you right up front that you forgive me if some of my comments aren't put delicately. First, I want to thank you for having the courage to dedicate the book's first chapter to your so-called autobiographical reflections, the personal history that prompted the work. I respect the fact that you could so freely admit your primary motive, yes, that's right, your primary motive for exploring the issue of religious fundamentalism is as follows. I was justifying to myself in a psychological sense and to others such as Orthodox family members in an intellectual sense, my heresy vis-a-vis orthodoxy. I was also expressing my latent resentment towards those teachers whom I felt in retrospect had been either dishonest, disparaging, or demeaning in the way in which they had responded to the religious doubts and questions I raised. It has always been my opinion, as it seems to be yours, that no scholar works in a vacuum. We are all shaped by our own upbringing, cultural biases, and worldviews. And as such, it's a matter of sheer academic integrity that we examine ourselves and be honest about our own perspectives, first to ourselves and second to our colleagues and readers. However, I wonder if perhaps you haven't allowed your perspective to drive rather than simply inform your scholarship. There is, to my mind, a difference between being upfront about one's bias and using one's bias as a foundation from which to launch, and you seem to employ your poor personal experiences with those in the orthodoxy fold as evidence for the negative moral or ethical consequences of scriptural fundamentalism. Reading your book, I found myself wondering over and again if that latent resentment you referenced wasn't so latent after all. As you yourself state, personal history and psychology may offer insight into the choice of one argument or view over another when neither can be definitively proven. Being such an acclaimed psychologist, I'm sure you're more than familiar with the phenomena whereby the abused becomes the abuser, and while it would be impossible to draw a direct parallel, I see a similar stream in your own writing. Whereby once your own character, intelligence, and motives were impugned when you rejected orthodoxy's doctrines and its claims to authority, now you impugn the character, intelligence, and motives of those who accept those very things. A few examples, though by no means an exhaustive list. One need only observe the Muslim Middle East in the past few decades to get a sense of the moral and ethical depravity rampant in some sectors of the Muslim world. Is it any wonder that the skeptic takes with a ton of salt the Muslim claim that the values its sacred Quran generates and the communities it nurtures are paragons of ethics and morality? Two. Once again, we see that very smart people can believe very stupid things, perhaps a guiding mantra of this book. Three. Millions of brain cells are devoted to defending, on ostensibly rational grounds, contradictions in the Bible, inconsistencies in their own dogmas, circularity in their reasoning, absurdities in their conclusions, cruelty in their doctrines, and selfishness in their social visions. They scurry to and from their inane logic and proofs, defending themselves against criticism instead of acknowledging their errors. Three. Arguing with a fundamentalist believer who appeals to reason often feels like trying to convince someone who is pathologically paranoid that his suspicions are based on delusions rather than reality. Five, on the Quran. It's like a parent who considers her ugly daughter to be the most beautiful child in the world. Oh yes, and number six, a personal favorite of mine. It's almost beneath the dignity of rational discourse to respond to such illogical, so-called logical arguments, but I sacrifice my dignity, oh, the martyr that you are, to point out the illogicality of some such proofs with the hope that this might undermine those Muslim believers' beliefs, assuming believers will read books like mine. And finally, quoting an Asked to Remain Anonymous correspondent, traditional religious faith, with few exceptions, was a major reason why the Holocaust happened. It boggles the mind how you can make statements like these while at the same time arguing for intellectual humility when attempting to explain a particular person's adherence of a religious worldview, or disparaging the fact that many Muslims see nothing improper in speaking with contempt about non-believers and in treating their sacred texts disrespectfully. Treating sacred texts disrespectfully? That seems like your major strength, Dr. Schimmel. Yes, you know, I just can't imagine why more Muslims are not interested in reading something that challenges their beliefs. Let me just say, if your goal truly is to persuade fundamentalists to give up their own beliefs and adopt more rational ones, the paternalistic afterthought mentioned on page 7, you failed miserably where one such fundamentalist is concerned. Now let's move to the meat. Your claim, for instance, that Orientalism, which was motivated and even shaped by the West's imperialist and colonialist denigration of Muslim culture, is somehow on the decline, couldn't be less true, as evidenced by the borderline racist claims you yourself make in the book. Perhaps one of the clearest examples of this is the statement that the moderate Imam Zaid Shakir is correct in his assertion that, quote, the view of any honest Muslim is a hope that one day the United States will be ruled by Sharia. That is not the view of many, many Muslims, Dr. Schimmel, myself and my family members included. What is the logical conclusion of these claims? That every Muslim, even the so-called moderate, read good ones, secretly hold these views that are a threat to the very fabric of democracy, and ergo, no Muslim can be trusted. If I may be so bold, I wonder how deep your study of Islam actually goes. In discussing, for example, the idea that the predestinarian view of human action coupled with punishment for the sinners is morally problematic, why are people being punished for actions over which they have no control? Did you know you were simply rephrasing a centuries-old argument of the Muslim Mu'tazilites? Rationality in Muslim history. Shocking, I know. Have you ever heard of the question of Qadr, God's divine power, and the obvious political implications it held for ancient Muslim societies? If you had, perhaps you would have been more careful about rehashing Ernest Renan's failed theses that there aren't any kind of rationalist enterprises in Islamic civilization. Given all these facts, I can't help but doubt the sincerity of your desire to engage in so-called honest, nonviolent debates that will enhance understanding, morality, and the positive contributions that religions can make to humanity. When it seems that the idea itself is an ideology you reject outright, and as you say audaciously in the book, there is no evidence of a moral order in the universe or of any divine theodicy of ultimate justice. Tell me, is agnosticism really the only acceptable form of rational belief?
Not the McGill Ghetto. Saturday, May 2nd at 2 p.m., join us for a walking tour to explore the rich fabric of the Milton Park neighborhood. From the mansions of the wealthy to the working class legacy, historic battles with developers, and North America's largest co-op community. The tour will be led by Lucia Kolick, president of the Milton Park Citizens Committee. Meet at Milton and University for the 90-minute walk, followed by a picnic, brought to you by Cupid McGill and James Walks. Please send an RSVP email to the address antigentrification@gmail.com, if possible. All are welcome.
This is a CKUT Club presentation.
Are you a budding journalist, an aspiring DJ? Want to be a radio star?
CKUT and the McGill Conservatory Day Camp present Radio Camp.
Learn to record and edit sound, produce documentaries and news segments for radio and podcast, conduct interviews, learn to DJ,
and at the end of the week, produce and host a live radio show all in a fun summer camp setting.
CKUT will run 6 one-week radio camp sessions from June 29th until August 21st, 2009.
We have sessions for 10 to 13 and 14 to 17 years old.
For more information and to register,
visit www.ckut.ca
or call 514-398-5505.
Check out the McGill Conservatory Day Camp's other performance art camps
at www.mcgill.ca/conservatory/camp.
This past February 21st, Gabatan Montreal hosted Monica, an employee of the Public Service Alliance of Canada, who had taken part in the Vancouver and District Labor Council Solidarity Labor Tour to the Philippines. The tour itself had four purposes. First, to understand the local context in a country that is second most dangerous in the world for labor unionists. Second, to draw common lines and build solidarity between Filipino and Canadian labor struggles. Third, to investigate particular sectors. And fourth, to understand the reason behind the increase in Filipino migration to Canada, and the reason for the push out of the Philippines leading to an increase in Filipino temporary foreign workers to Canada. She spoke about internal displacement and home destructions due to globalization and industrial development, call centers, labor rights, unionization, urban poor struggles, and peasant struggles, all occurring in an atmosphere of increased militarization in the Philippines. Following are two segments, selected specifically because they address the plight of women in the Philippines and the impulse to take action and organize. These situations, however, are not exclusive to the Philippines. These are realities in many, if not all, developing countries whose governments lend their terms to the forces of globalization and so-called economic development, rather than to the service of their citizens. The first segment addresses the atmosphere of threat due to the increased militarization of the country targeting organizers. It highlights a visit to Marikina, where school teachers come organizers managed to achieve a 90% unionization rate, and the story of an organizer named Jane, targeted by the military, who visited her house.
So this is now kind of like the first struggle that we went to with Marikina. If you don't know Manila very well, Marikina is a little bit south of Manila. it was quite interesting actually to go to Marikina because there, the a national teachers organization called ACERT hosted us there, and they talked about their unionization drive. And in the Philippines, unionization is quite difficult because it's very legalistic. You have to have, you know, board certification, you know, bureaucracy, you get this general recognition, and are you going to get formal recognition from the employer, or you have to force them to recognize you so they have to go to court. So that usually takes a longer process, which is why not that many people are under a collective agreement. So what they decided to do, because they knew that takes a long time, that whole process, is that they tried a new tactic. Instead of organizing school by school, so that's normally how you do it when you're organizing a lot. You organize this factory, then you organize this one, they decided to organize all the schools in the entire division. So over 50 schools, 53 schools. So if you times it by how many teachers, about 50 teachers in each school, depending on how many students, it's quite a lot. And they struggled for quite a long time to organize the teachers. And they have different challenges. I was saying to you in the Yersigal Nambaya interview, I was talking to Josie, that they have different issues. Sure, it was like, you know, wages, like I mentioned, they only make 9,000 a month, you know, but it's also the school curriculum. They're really, really challenging that because their textbooks are edited by IMF, World Bank. Their training as teachers are sometimes provided by private corporations. So they question the bias that these private corporations are providing in their training. So there's also those kind of aspects. And there's a Magna Carta for teachers where they're supposed to be these different things. And they want to uphold to the International Labor Organization ratio about teaching. In this school that we went to, their ratio was only about 1 to 53, 1 teacher to 53 students, which is like horrible for in Canadian standards because, we know, anyways, in BC, you know, they went on strike for like 1 to 30 kind of thing. But here it's 1 to 53. But we've also heard as high as 1 to 100 students. And as there's no supplies in the schools, the students are bringing their own chairs to the class because of the lack of funding. The other aspect is that when you think about the basic level of education in the Philippines, it's only 10 years, right? Because they go to college a little bit earlier. But there's actually some analysis about that because there's some discussion about, well, we should add like a grade 7. I guess they only have like 1 to 6. And then, you know, junior, senior, freshman, all that things that I don't know how they call that. So they have 4 more years of that. So there's some movement to have add a grade 7. But the reason they don't want to add a grade 7 is not anything really about the curriculum or about the what is the content of the classes, but it's about the money. Because then it's an additional year of schooling that the federal or national government of the Republic of the Philippines, would have to pay. So these are some of the demands that the teachers were raising, and they were actually able to get 90% voluntary union certification. For those of you who have experience in organizing, I know you know that's hard. That's really, really difficult. So what happened is after their successful unionization is that they were targeted by the military. The military came and visited these schools, and they were in full battle gear, just last year. Full battle gear, traumatizing these children because these schools were elementary and high school. And they came in and did anti-insurgency seminars. So they weren't saying that ACERT was an insurgent, but they're implying that anyone who would be against the government is an insurgent. Hence, these people who are unionizing, you should think of all what you're doing. So Jane, which is the picture there to the left, the bottom, she was one of the main organizers. They visited her school second, and they picked Jane out. She's one of the ACERT organizers. So for her, and she was also visited at her home. So at her home, this is her daughter right beside her in the red. At her home, when the military visited her, there's one military man, he is in plain clothes, but he said that he was military, and he gave a name. And then they were talking, but it seemed to be getting intense. And for some reason, this child, you know, she's only like 6 or whatever, maybe 7, she had the presence of mind to grab their camera and take a picture of herself. As soon as she did that, he left. And then when they checked later on about who the man was and the name and all kinds of things, that was fake. All of it. So she had the presence of mind, no? And when you see her, you can imagine that she must have also been traumatized by it because she just clings to her mom. Anywhere her mom was walking or talking to us or showing us to school, she was just, you know, she's always attached to her mom because I think she has this traumatization about the military visiting.
The second segment speaks about the unjust treatment of women maquila workers who find themselves having to pay to work in a no-strike, no-union workplace.
But the important thing was that we got to talk to a lot of women workers in this area, because this is right near the Maksang Export Processing Zone. So Export Processing Zone is kind of like the maquiladoras of Mexico and things like this, no? No strike, no union policies in this area. So this was kind of like a combination. So what I found is, if you could see it, I know it's hard to imagine, but we were in this walled area of the urban port. And if you looked over the wall, there's McDonald's. And here's this big wall. And, you know, like, it's just so hidden, the poverty. So they just built up higher and higher walls to hide the poverty. And if you just look over the wall, there you would see these beautiful malls. And this is where the parking lot's going to be, because they're going to destroy this urban poor community, no? So these women worked in the extra processing zone that's nearby. But they meet in the community because, of course, they can't meet at the workplace. And we tried to get in there. We drove by. So we drove in to here. This is the entrance here. And they stopped us cold. They made us turn around. So then we had to take, like, exit photos. So that's why we were able to take this photo, for example. And then as we were driving by, took this photo. So you can see, like, hundreds of workers. There's a shift change. Hundreds of workers coming out. You know? And so, and you also hear the Philippine Economic Zone Authority. So they have their own police force in the export processing zone. So when we were in the community, that's when they got to talk. So they were really able to stand up and talk about their experience in the export processing zone. They worked for Timex, Texas Instruments, and some of them worked for like 20, 25 years. But they said that the constant pressure, of course, is the contractualization. Especially for the long-timers, they are trying to edge them out so that they're so they have no more regular workers, and it's going to be all just by contract. And then related to that is it's a total money-making scheme for the government. So imagine, you're only getting like maybe 200 pesos a day because you don't get minimum wage when you go in here. But in order to get that job, which will only last 6 months, you have to pay for your birth certificate. You have to pay for your mayor's clearance, barangay clearance. You have to pay for agency percentage. You have to pay for x-ray, NBI clearance, schedule. And so you add that all up. And soon enough, you're using up most of your money. So not only does your 200 pesos a day is not enough for your family of four or five, but now you have these additional things that you're paying even before you get the job. And if you only work 6 months, you have to save that money or put that money aside, because you have to pay it again the next time you apply, even if it's the same job, even if it's the same company. So it really, so on one hand, you know, they create these extra processing zones, and the government allows that they don't unionize and they can't go on strike and things like this. But on the other hand, and it's so they get the minimum wages. Then on the other hand, the government is making all this money. So that's all the different levels of government. Mayor, FBI, NSO, giving that birth certificate and all this. And then for what? Especially if you have to do it every 6 months and it's the same employer, why do you have to repeat? Did you just suddenly break the law within 6 months? I don't know. Did you change your name and didn't you change your birth certificate? Like, there's nothing that really changes in those time periods. But it's a money making. It's a money making. So a lot of them eventually give up working because they cannot, on one hand, try to be working and then save money for this whole process of the clearance before they get to work. So then they most of them join the informal economy.
May 3rd, the Words of Music show goes to Le KGB for a fabulous show featuring music by Pharmacon MTL, music by Lisa Gamble, dance by Mary Williamson and Angela Hibb, performance by Alan Lento, and spoken word by the fabulous Catalyst, with special guest Tomiaka Lukchuk. It's the Words of Music show at Le KGB, 5490 Saint-Laurent, Sunday, May 3rd, doors open 8, show starts 9, $5. It's a CKUT co-presentation.
And Spitfire is back with our next topic of discussion, the emerging industry of what has been nicely termed as reproductive tourism, or in other words, transnational surrogacy. A simple Google search shows that India has succeeded in making headlines as a world leader in reproductive technology and services. In 2008, a 15-member committee, including experts from the Indian Council of Medical Research, the Ministry of Health, and specialists in the field, got together and drafted a bill entitled the Assisted Reproduction Technology Bill. The purpose of the bill is to weed out bad practitioners by regulating this industry through standards of care. It does not address the feminization of poverty or gender discrimination. Instead, this bill essentially legalizes systemic gender inequality. The economic interests of IVF clinics, placement agencies, medical specialists from the private sector, and the Indian state are being met, as are first world demands for surrogate mothers. The cost of surrogacy in India is relatively more cost efficient for consumers, and prospective parents face less red tape and wait times. In fact, many online articles have reported various participants in the process claiming that this relationship is, quote, mutually beneficial. One prospective father reportedly said, quote, "She, the surrogate, is getting the money she wants, and we are getting the baby that we are desperate for," end quote. A BBC online news piece entitled "Regulators Eye India's Surrogacy Sector" stated that the country's surrogacy industry is exploding and is now estimated to be worth more than $500 million a year. Compared to the cost of surrogacy in places like the UK, India can provide the service for roughly a third of that price, including cost of airfare, medical procedures, and hotels. Meanwhile, women's rights to equality are not being enforced. In legalizing transnational surrogacy, the Indian state is discharging its duty to treat all of its citizens equally by not addressing issues of historical disadvantage and structural injustice that result from gender discrimination. Structural injustice involves gender discrimination within the family, access to education, access to employment, access to state benefits, and access to the public sphere generally. Historically, women have faced and continue to face these obstacles disproportionately when compared to men because of how our biological difference from men is socially regulated by the state and constructed through dominant sexist values and norms. These man-made obstacles lead to what women all over the world have coined the feminization of poverty. From a geopolitical perspective, the Indian state is satisfying first-world demands to the detriment of domestic women's rights. Interesting that part of the discourse within the first world about Indian women is that they are seen as relatively virtuous and clean as compared to other third world women, creating a hierarchy of third world women based on race and perceived culture. Moreover, this perception also links into ideas of how still motherhood is conceived of through a virtuous women lens as cultural marker, so that only virtuous women are fit to bear children. In the context of first world perceptions of Indian women and culture, the Indian state has opted to fan the flames of nationalism and promote itself as the leader in reproductive tourism, the best and most cost-efficient place to purchase this kind of service in the world, instead of committing itself to eradicating gender inequality. These relations of power at the international and domestic levels result in the exploitation of women and the feminization of poverty on an international scale. First world couples using third world women as surrogates illustrates how the commodification of third world women's bodies is for the purpose of satisfying the consumption demands of first world couples. Moreover, surrogacy is being spoken about as an unproblematic financial option for Indian women to take advantage of. Transnational surrogacy is being promoted as a positive development for Indian women looking for ways to support their families and pay their bills in a context where class, caste, gender, and notions of the family are sizable obstacles for women to becoming financially independent. The legalization of this process in India must be evaluated and understood within this context. In India, the placement agencies, clinics, and doctors all receive a disproportional amount of the revenue generated from these arrangements as compared to the third world surrogate mother in terms of the work contributed to the production of the good, babies. At the same time, care of the third world surrogate mother is privatized. Prospective parents pay for her health care while she serves their consumption needs, and then she is cut off. Reports also mention that some prospective parents expect to have control over their surrogate's mobility to ensure that the goods are not put in danger. Meanwhile, the Indian state remains stagnant in providing women's access to services, such as healthcare. Will the bill pass? It's hard to say, but hopefully not. If the bill goes through, surrogate mothers ought to receive more than just a fee for the use of their bodies as the site for reproductive technology. They are also entitled to compensation for what they have gone through as human beings. In Quebec, surrogacy contracts are considered null. In other words, the state does not even recognize the use of a woman's body for the production of in vitro babies as a valid contractual event. While some may opine that this is a heavy-handed policy and impedes too greatly the free choice of different individuals, it is arguable that the main purpose of this policy is to target attempts to commercialize surrogacy and women's bodies, a policy that is in tune with women's equality. Another possible policy response would be an outright ban on surrogacy, criminalizing all parties involved in the process, including the surrogate. However, this approach is arguably not nuanced enough to capture the unequal power relationship between the Indian state, geopolitical pressures, reproductively disabled first world couples, and third world women. Criminalizing women when their economic and social vulnerability is being exploited for commercial reasons is not fair. Moreover, a more nuanced policy response is preferable because it could reduce the tendency to victimize women and speak to women's agency instead. The lines may be thin, but there is an important qualitative difference between being a victim and being vulnerable. The same goes for valuing choice and having options so that the exercise of our choice is meaningful. I'm tired of being valued solely for my body, however wonderful it is. How about you? Thanks for listening.
Team send me, I go left all your friend them. Fuck you, straight to the captain, girl. Me a tell you, send me one a girl. Listen, me need a girl, they run a cop and pen. Your team send me, I go ramp with your baby. Your team send me, I go ramp with you.
Asia One there, right out of Toronto. You're listening to Spitfire Radio. It is 90.3 CKUT. The time is 6:38, and right now we're going to go to a little bit on a surge in anti-Black racism post-Obama by Alyssa Clutterbuck. Are you there, Liz?
Yes, I am. Hello, ladies.
Hi.
This is via correspondence. I'm sorry I can't be in the studio, and I wrote this piece in lieu of my own personal experiences in Toronto and what I had been seeing in the media or not been seeing enough of in the media. And I'm calling this piece The Obama Era and Anti-Black Racism, The Surge is Hurting. So it sounds like this. Many of us cried out in pride, and all of us had to stop and watch the November 4th election as the first black president of the United States. The New York Times front page headline decried, racial barrier shattered. The 2 million strong at the inauguration, and of course, the newly anointed first couple's first dance to At Last by none other than Beyonce, added to the celebration. We cried even more that night. All over the United States, whose original sin of enslavement and genocide has left an irremovable tarnish, journalists, intellectuals, and citizens alike declared the official beginning of a post-racial America. Black and people of color could take up their rightful whole humanity. But while Obama gave his victory speech in a Chicago park, the plotting had begun. The National Knights of the Ku Klux Klan sent out the call. Members, wear your black armbands and fly the American flag upside down on Inauguration Day, they called. The same night the president-elect told us, yes, we can, two prominent white supremacist websites crashed because their servers were overwhelmed with hits. Former Louisiana State Representative and white supremacist leader David Duke responded to Obama's election by saying, we, as in we white people, have got to stand up and fight now. Okay, but we all know white supremacists organizations are just kooks and they're extremists, right? But if Obama has already had more death threats than any other president, what does that say? The mainstream media has officially dismissed these incidents as isolated. But then the reports started to come in and come in. Anger, violence, nooses hanging, decapitated black figurines, racial epithets on black people's cars and homes, Obama posters with the N-words over them, burning crosses, increased enrollment in white supremacist organizations across North America as a whole. Reports of school children yelling, assassinate Obama. Reports of school children attacking black children. On top of this always is the always persistent mainstream corporate media that turns away completely from the ugliness of this kind of white supremacy and the specific forms of hatred spewed at black people. The media would rather drink the Kool-Aid, favoring a disgustingly superficial story about the end of racism through the channeling of hope and unity through Obama's messages. Still, the hate keeps coming. North American hate crimes specifically targeting black people have increased almost threefold since last year. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, there are now 900 operating hate groups in the United States, a 40% increase from 2000. Perhaps the most saddening fact is not the rise in these sentiments, but that the main reason for the anger, that being Obama's victory, has not resulted in real and meaningful improvements for black communities. Quite the contrary, actually. Barack may be the first black president, but he is definitely not the first pro-black or even the first non-anti-black president. African-American and African-Canadian unemployment surges ahead of all other employment, and the foreclosure crisis in the United States has left black America with one-fifth of the assets it once had before the economic crisis began. We have just passed the symbolic 100-day threshold of his first term. And today, Black Agenda Report, it's an online blog and commentary website, gives Obama 1 out of 5 overall for addressing issues affecting black America, the one they gave him just for hope that his policies toward the constituency from which his political ascendancy began will drastically change for the better. As the hate spews towards black communities in lieu of this black president, as black communities dry up because jobs dry up, as our people are needlessly murdered and incarcerated, black people face an unprecedented crisis in an unprecedented era of unprecedented circumstances. We need a president to fight for people of color more than ever. We cannot allow the media to continue to ignore the assault on our communities, and we cannot witness a president that was largely elected by people of color turn his back during this downturn when we need him the most. And that's my piece.
And she looks a lot like me.
She's white.
Hey. I hear you found a new love.
What's her name, kid?
And she looks a lot like me.
I heard she's biting my style. Hey.
I hear you found a new love.
Hey.
And she looks a lot like me.
I heard she's biting my style, kid.
Hey, found a new love.
What's her name, kid?
And she looks a lot like me.
I heard she's biting my style. The bittersweet, so you walk back in the spot. Swagger on your grin, same cocky on that walk. He's got that cherry on top. Flooded the feedback. Remember lips to shape, they move up close, the vocal relax. Ooh, close eyes show improved, sure bet, stick and move. Ride the silver dresses long, take a grip, my moves. Honey dip, you got them blues in me. Cusick, don't sound the way you used to be. Sick king, you're losing me. I'm struggling to find you, said you're leaving. Inspiration all behind you. Friends, cousins, friends telling me there's someone new. Friends will still pretend, yeah, he's coming home to you. Well, let it go. No hold, no grudges, no hard feelings. Know it's worth the while for these glances. You keep stealing new love. What's your new love? Who's your new love? Hey,
found a new love.
Hey,
she looks a lot like.
I heard she's biting my stack. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Hey.
I hear you found a new love.
What's her name, kid?
And she looks a lot like me.
I heard she's biting my stack. Huh. Who's your new love? I sound bad, I cut the chatter. I'm just talking what the weather, yeah, you know I roll. You chose the lesser. Oh, non-aggressive when I walk and they just talk about my shit, cause you know pantyhose. Take the time out. I do my makeup, purse my lips, then do the zips before a couple sips, then rock a show. Since the breakup, you the hiccup, drinking water, looking hotter, cause I got it when I let it grow. Maybe hurt, you're still finding yourself, reminding yourself. Words worth recording in a studio. Maybe worse, you're still blundering self and fiend for the wealth. Words turn into a different type of low. And when you kiss her, she knows the shallow, I'm deep and slow. The insecure and childish pure get wild before I run it cold. Following these lines on some ego strokes. Baby had a dime, now I'm fine, so I just let him go. Hey.
I hear you found a new love.
Hey.
And she looks a lot like me.
I heard she's biting my stack. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Hey.
I hear you found a new love.
What's her name, kid?
And she looks a lot like me.
I heard she's biting my stack.
Life after you ain't really been much. Everyone I met ain't never been loved. You know, I like it short like my conversations, but you're the only star in my constellation. Too much pride, that's why I hesitate to call you. But like the seasons, I always put May before June. Sometimes I feel love was made to fall through, but I guess how I acted made it all true. So now I'm here in this bed that I made, giving half to this woman, not the whole she might claim. I know she might be what I need for the moment, but her and I shouldn't be. If I'm seeing a closing, hoping for a flashback, a rewind, so for I to get past that, I need time. I know it ain't some special news. I guess for her to get closer, she try to stencil you.
I do the book launch.
Hello. Okay, so what's up, CKUT listeners? This is Angelica for Spitfire Radio. I'm going to share a piece. It's untitled as yet, but I try to write things that are not reactionary, but there have been some things that have been going on, and part of our role as citizens, as humans, is witness, and also to call people on some stuff. So that's my breakdown of this piece. Nobody I know is part of the prison industrial complex, so I express my privilege by not pretending to be from the streets. I'm conscious of it every time I sit my ass down in a seat that was probably constructed by neo-slave labor. I don't read the morning papers, instead I choose to focus on news that's glued to lampposts. I own my university degree, though I haven't quite finished paying for it, literally or literally. I managed to escape relatively unscathed from the delusion that education is a right because it's a privilege. I've only ever lived in houses, so I don't dumb it down and act disaffected, dress like I'm homeless because it gets me more attention on Facebook. Tweet, tweet. I'm not a model minority, just one generation separates me from refugees. My daddy speaks broken English so that I could forget Vietnamese before I even learned it. I had to backtrack when I backpacked as a foreigner coming home for the second time. To earn $10 an hour overseas is a privilege. Nobody I know has ever OD'd, so I express my privilege by not calling myself a hustler. Addiction isn't funny, and we're the only species that rewards our young with food that's destructive. I have the knowledge to cook my own meals and a kitchen to do it, so I eat, share, and regurgitate my privilege. I know my way around a rhyme, but I'm kinda scared of beats. My physical packaging guarantees me a niche, but I choose not to run with a gimmick. So I pay respect to my feet, planted firmly and low to the ground by default. That's just life. We're all privileged. How do you live with the way that you feel it? I want to shout out Malek for finishing her degree. Many hopes that you will pay for it soon.
What, 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 what? And I will own it, too.
Yo, 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 this is the one them called Jason.
Yeah, yeah, Zip's original, Zip Natural Good. Come on now.
Filling in for Community, representing, saying CKUT, big up, the station to listen to.
90.3, 90.3, tune in, 90.3, 90.3, CKUT, 90.3, best love.
Consciousness. Deport them.
I keep messing up the microphones. Hi, guys. It's Josie. Welcome back to Spitfire. I guess we're finishing up with some announcements. I have three. First, we were playing Meja One a little bit on the show today, and she's going to be performing this Friday at the Belmont at 4483 Saint Laurent, and tickets are $15, so you should check that out. And also, UGAT, Sharing Our Pinoyville Stories, Understanding Our Roots. It's a conference that's led by the Kapit Bisig Center, including Kabataang Montreal, the Filipino Youth Organization. And they're having a fundraiser next, not this coming Saturday, the Saturday after May 9th at 8 p.m. And it's going to be at the Montreal Urban Community Sustainment, or MUCS, at 2000 Northcliff, number 218, Vendôme Metro. And it's a $5 to $10 donation at the door. So you can find more information if you look up ugatconference.blogspot.com, ugatconference.blogspot.com. And finally, for my announcement, Push It Real Good, which takes place on May 23rd.
That's right.
Ooh, baby, baby.
It's a day of exploring racialized and indigenous queer and trans identities in a unique framework. This two-part day of events will kick off at the 2110 Center for Gender Advocacy at 2110 Mackay, with workshops from Ottawa's queer anti-racist group Agitate and members of the local community. These workshops will focus on internalized racism, homophobia, and transphobia, and on drawing on our strength to produce art. Part two of Push It Real Good will take place at the St. Emily Skillshare at 3942 St. Emily. There will be an art show celebrating the work of racialized and Indigenous artists, bands, and a dance party featuring DJs from Ontario and Quebec. This is a day to discuss, celebrate, and promote self-representation and self-determination in our own communities, to support resistance, and to build networks in order to strengthen our movements. So for more information, please email pushmontreal@gmail.com.
Okay, and we've got a couple more events for you to get your pen out, write it down in your little agenda, because I know I keep mine up to date. Friday, May 1st, 8 o'clock, With Words is happy and proud to present our Spring 2009 authors, Melissa Bull, Allison McMaster, and Edward Petarenko. This book launch is happening at Les Trois Minots, 3812 Saint Laurent, and it will be hosted by Anne Ward and Sasha Minoli. That's doors at 8, readings at 8:45. And then the second event, which we're very excited to bring you, is the No One Is Illegal May Day of Action Rally and March. That's happening this Saturday, May 2nd, 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock, Allen Gardens. You'll find them at Sherbourne Street. And that's to commemorate the over 100 temporary and undocumented workers who were attacked by armed border guards April 2nd and 3rd, dragged into detention, and are now being forcibly deported. Thousands of us will take to the streets May 2nd, and we will say enough is enough.
Tomorrow night, the Alfie Roberts Institute is going to bring a special film evening, presenting Gloria Rolando, a Cuban filmmaker, and this is going to be an event that is a little bit long. It's 6:30 to 11. I mean that in a way that it is going to be featuring two films, so two of Gloria's films. One is on Cuba's West Indian population, and the other is a documentary on Assata Shakur, who has political asylum in Cuba. So and the filmmaker is going to be in-house. So the event is $20. I know that's a little bit steep, but for nonprofit organizations that are really that.
So lifeblood.
You know, and it's not like it's not going to be worth it, and bringing people in from Cuba who are revolutionary is not cheap either. So it is at the Maison de la Culture in Côte de Neige, and there is a Facebook event created for it, so check that out, Gloria Rolando, as part of the Alfie Roberts Institute tomorrow. May.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of Spitfire Women of Color Radio. We're on every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. till 7 p.m. And we appreciate our listeners. So thanks very much. This was Spitfire Radio, Women of Color.
Turn it up.
Are we on the air?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, on the air.
All over the world, man. Gotta make that money, man. Make your money, y'all. Just do what you got to do.
Nothing gain, nothing try. Very few even try. Most just wanna get high. From the cradle to the grave. Don't wanna be your slave. And I'm not gonna take it how you wanna. Love me or hate me. Support me or snake me. Either way I show love. Let it make me or break me. I'm the queen of self-esteem. Don't sweat the cream. Just set the scene. Get the cream like how you mean. Straight up. On a string, like them hoes sucking on your thing, overworked and underpaid for days. Behave, I'm not gonna be your slave.
People screaming hardcore, living in the ghetto, sleeping on the floor. What you thought I was gonna breath for great God out the sky. Best live your life, cause you just waiting to die. People still taking life for a joke. Can't see the fire, but you blow out of smoke. If you didn't get it, you got what you deserve. Just like that, that's my word. Every day I wake up, seeming on the come up. No daydreaming, got to stay one up. How you gonna sit back and wait on the wealth? Gotta go get it, motivate yourself. If not, you only perpetrate yourself. And at the end of the day, you only hate yourself. If you know me, you know my mind. Take it.
Mother.